for you in every major city, eventually every city and town. Federal regulations require funeral homes to quote prices over the phone. You don't have to go in person, so we can call them all up and compare what they charge. He paused. Sometimes they try to refuse, make it tough, imply you really have to drop by. Those are the sneaky ones I love to get. I used to blast them on the phone, ream them. Now I play along, let them refuse, then I write the FTC and send a copy of the letter to the home. Afterwards, I call up and blast them. Only now they got me and the FTC together, kind of a 1-2 punch, you know. Nice business practice. Obviously, something about the funeral industry has gotten under Lenny's skin. Pretty compelling, right? He asked. One of the regulars at the next table smiled as he rose to leave, carefully folding the business section of the Merc and cradling it under his arm. Very compelling, kid. Can I invest? He winked at me as he walked into the sunshine, offering what was probably the only bite Lenny had gotten on the fundraising trail. How do you know people want to make these decisions on the internet? I asked. Lenny beamed. Here comes the internet pitch. I realized just a second too late. He gathered himself and once again reached over and flipped several pages in the presentation to Randy Commissar Binder. The internet changes everything. Why drive to the bookstore to buy a book when you can order it from your couch and receive it FedEx the next day? Why buy airline tickets from your local travel agency when you can take control of your schedule and pricing online and accept your e-ticket at the gate? Why buy milk from the local market when you can check off a box on your screen and have it delivered by noon? Lenny's rendition of the future made me feel like a prisoner in my own home. Do you have a graph of internet profits? I asked. Lenny glared at me. It was a joke. Few internet companies at that time were willing to discuss profits, let alone produce them. No one knows what a piece of the internet is really worth, or which economic models will ultimately produce profits, but everyone's betting their patch is rich bottom land, and they're willing to place their bets before anyone is shown they can grow much of anything on it. The market will eventually sort it all out, but the land grab is on. You don't get it, do you? Lenny said. Let me explain. With that, he launched into yet another rehearsed speech. Obviously, he had developed micro-pitch modules, and now I was getting the one on the current economics of the internet, or the lack of them, and why the really smart companies were building brand and staking out territory at the expense of profits. He said he'd never invest in a company that expected to make a profit in the near future on the internet. Soon as they make a profit, they've fallen behind. It's growth or profits, etc., etc., etc. I wondered whether there could ever be enough day traders to keep these leaky boats afloat. While Lenny blasted on, I imagined myself standing outside the Konditorei, looking in through the picture window to see the pitchman wind up for another inning and wondering how the other guy, me, managed to sit so still as the ball came toward him. My secret was counting my breaths, in, out, as I planned my escape. His idea was intriguing in some ways, but it was mostly just another plan for flogging merchandise on the internet, and esoteric merchandise at that. It wasn't his intensity that irritated me. I expected that in people who found companies. They have to be a little irrational, passionate beyond analysis. If they don't believe in the face of doubt, they'll never make it. But Lenny was operating on automatic pilot set all the way to frantic. I'd have to tell Frank that Lenny and I talked, but we never really connected. Frank would have to come to his own conclusions. A cell phone rang. It wasn't mine. I don't own one. Lenny paused mid-sentence. For future reference, here was one way to interrupt his relentless pitch. It rang again. He opened his briefcase on the table, snatched out his phone, and snapped it open. "Lenny here," he said as he strode out the door, without a word to me. Rudeness is as good an excuse as any for an exit. I pulled my jacket off the back of the chair with one last look at Lenny's open briefcase. It revealed a stack of files, an assortment of pens, a family picture stuck on with a paperclip, an economy-sized bottle of Pepto-Bismol, and some kind of homemade sandwich. Tuna salad? Oozing around the edge of the plastic wrapper. Well, I thought, somebody loves him enough to make a sandwich. Or maybe he's brown bagging to save money. I told Connie I'd be back later. She promised to hold my regular table. We both watched Lenny as he sat at one of the tables just outside the open door. Still oblivious to the possibility that someone might overhear, he argued and pleaded into the phone. Wait, you didn't accept, did you? You said 6 months. No, one more month. We made a commitment. Sounds like trouble, Connie said to me. Sounds like someone is bailing out, I said. No, it's too important, Lenny yelped. Remember what we said after my dad's funeral. Ah, Connie said. Someone did die. I knew it. No, not 100, Lenny argued. Commissar's only number 26. Well, Connie said, 26, you've moved up. You deserve a better table. No, he loves it, Lenny said. I can see he's in. Frank, fund it. I get it, Connie said. You're rushing home to get your checkbook, right? Now I rolled my eyes. Listen, one more month, just a month. Please, please, give me... He was still talking, but to my surprise, his voice had downshifted, so we couldn't hear him, even as we both strained toward the door. He slumped, wordless, as though the wind had been knocked out of him. Is he all right? Connie whispered to me. He sat still, his head down, the phone dangling in his hand. I had to admit, this was a different Lenny. For a second, I was a bit worried about him. Slowly, Lenny sat up and gathered himself. He put the phone back to his ear and spoke again. The words, 2 more weeks, were clear enough. So, Mr. Last Chance 26, you were leaving? Connie wanted to know. She looked at me hard. How about another chai? She asked finally. On the house. Perhaps this wasn't the most opportune moment to sneak out. I still had some time before my next meeting, and for all his bravado, this kid could really use a clue. I took my coat off. My friend out there, I said, he'd like a decaf. Chapter 2. The Rules of the Game. Lenny, though subdued for the moment, was likely to spring back to life and resume his story of those putrefying bacteria, probably in the middle of lunch. So why was I still here? A couple of reasons, I suppose. My father's parents were Russian immigrants. My mother's family came off the boat from Germany. Both sets of grandparents left their homelands for a new and unknown world. It was a courageous bet on a vision, simple faith. I see a common gene among immigrants and entrepreneurs who strike out from the pack to pursue their dreams. I admire people who are willing to bet everything on a belief. Some of these risk-takers, whether immigrants or entrepreneurs, have a profound impact on what happens in the world. They place bets on the future, often against fantastic odds. I see heroism in that. The other reason is simpler still. On one or two occasions in my own history, I've been helped by people who should have given me the boot for my naive and disruptive zealotry. I have been sympathetic to the plight of true believers ever since. I carried Lenny's coffee out to his curbside table. The center's shopkeepers were all arriving for their various businesses. A woman's boutique, a video rental, come post office, a liquor store noted for its fine wines. Everyone dropped by the Konditorei for their morning java, exchanging pleasantries. no virtual mall could ever replace this small-town feel. Technology does have its limitations. Still, preoccupied with his phone call, Lenny was surprised to see me and started to get up. "I'll get the presentation," he said. "We can finish out here." "Sit down, Lenny. Let's just talk." "What will you tell Frank?" he asked as he sipped his coffee. Concern and frustration passed over his pallid face. "I don't really know. If Frank called me right now, I'd have to say I don't completely understand funerals.com. Or you." Lenny leaned forward to protest, but I cut him off. "Lenny, I've seen some great ideas. Palm Pilot, WebTV, Intuit. They all struggled in their early days, but persevered in the face of many skeptics." "Struggled? I've got people interested," he countered, obviously eager to reassure himself. "Any term sheets?"
"Not yet."
"What interest do you have, then?" 4 or 5 VCs say it's a good idea. They want me to get back to them when I'm further along. If I can produce a credible lead investor, others will follow."
"Ah, that's what I thought.
VCs have no percentage in telling you no outright. A no from a venture capitalist is as rare as the no of a Japanese salaryman. Unless you mug the receptionist on the way out or spray graffiti all over their German sedans, VCs seldom turn you down outright. The other day, a prominent VC described how cutthroat his business had become. One-time friends are bludgeoning each other to win deals. My buddy had gotten cold feet on a deal just as another firm made a move on the founder. "I went crazy to close that financing before it walked out the door," he said. "Wait a minute," I protested. "It was a bad deal."
"Sure," he said, "but I couldn't let somebody else steal it."
So I asked Lenny, why would they tell him no? He might improve the idea, or his team, or some other investor might get excited, and then those on the sidelines would swarm in and create a frenzy. Or who knows, if not this time, his next idea could be a winner. Might as well keep the door open. My news was a splash of cold water. Lenny leaned back in his chair. He pursed his lips and shook his head. He had probably suspected as much after all these months, but hadn't been able to admit it to himself or his partner. "They were still interested," he persisted. "I could tell." "Listen, why don't we look at funerals.com the way a VC actually would," I suggested. "A VC asks a set of threshold questions about every business proposal. Let's walk through those and see where they come out." I took his silence for assent. I'm sure he would have preferred to finish his pitch, but I didn't give him a choice. "VCs," I explained, "want to know 3 basic things. Is it a big market? Can your product or service win over and defend a large share of that market? Can your team do the job?" VCs like to target markets with big potential, especially tiny markets growing quickly into big markets, like the internet. If it's a small market, the chance for a portfolio-levitating, reputation-making home run isn't there. A VC's portfolio return is an average of all its investments, so he'd rather have a huge winner and some no-ops than a bunch of minor successes. If you're off target slightly in a big market, you might still make it. And if you make it, it can still be big. Off target in a small market means you're dead. "So," I asked, "how big is the market for all this funerary gear?" "According to Lenny's research, there are more than 2 million funerals every year in the U.S. The average funeral and burial cost, close to $7,000. That makes a $14 billion market. About a third of that is for the items funerals.com was slated to sell. That made Lenny's overall market $4 to $5 billion, a sizable target." "How much of that will be sold online, do you suppose?"
"Maybe 25% in 3 years."
"But isn't that a problem, Lenny? Your projected sales of $100 million in 3 years amount to what share of the internet slice of that market?"
10% or so."
"Do you expect a lot of competition?"
Hell no. Maybe a couple, but we'll be the leader.
With 10% of the market? It doesn't foot.
Perhaps $1.25 billion internet market was too big a guess, but $100 million in sales suggested he wasn't headed for market leadership. If that was true, it was a problem, because top VCs only want to invest in potential leaders. As most markets grow and eventually consolidate, only the leading one or two players are likely to make money and see their share prices rise. So plans ordinarily promise that the new company will dominate its market. If Lenny didn't think this way, VCs would conclude something was wrong with his projections or his ambition. On the other hand, his market share might be much greater than 10%, because the total online market for funeral gear might be smaller than he projected. Either way, he would have to sort it out. Funerals.com would face the same issues other internet retailers face. How much of the market for their goods will shift to the internet? In the case of Funerals.com, would the business find a way to redirect sales from local funeral homes? Lenny could only guess. Fundamental to his plan was the assumption that the children of baby boomers would be more willing than their parents to buy these goods electronically. So, following his reasoning, it was important to stake out the territory now and prepare for the growing number of baby boomers who will start swelling the funeral market in the next few decades. Of course, it didn't help Lenny that virtually everyone he'd been talking to, including me, is a baby boomer. We would like to believe we make cool, rational decisions, but not many pitches force the pitchee to contemplate his own mortality.
So you think it would interest Frank more if we decreased our estimate of the total share of business moving to the net? He asked.
Not necessarily. That could result in too small a target market to be interesting. I assume you estimated your sales bottoms up and projected the market tops down. But either you've underestimated your sales or you've overestimated the potential market. You don't see yourself as the leader, or you believe the online funeral business is pretty small, you won't get much interest.
But I figured we could show that, even conservatively, we can build a nice, profitable business.
Fine. But make that the worst case in your plan. Maybe it reduces some risk, but those market share numbers won't inspire investors. Don't even try to do this if you aren't planning to take it all. Then allow for some competitors, but hold the leadership spot. Nothing else is worth investing in.
Good. That's good, he scribbled notes.
I put my feet up on one of the white plastic garden chairs that serve as cafe furniture in Portola Valley. When he was done, I asked, Lenny, why is this a big idea?
It's a big market and big dollars.
Will it change the way the world operates? Will it change people's lives in a meaningful way?
Change the world?
We're saving some people from the sharks that prey on grief. The current system is awful. Basically, you're just changing the way the product is sold and bought, substituting yourself for some brick-and-mortar intermediaries.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing. It's probably a good business strategy. How do you see the business in 5 years, though?
$400 million? $500 million? Who knows?
But it's the same thing, right? Same product sold the same way.
Yes, he said hesitantly, as though he were missing something.
Is that a problem? He asked.
Not necessarily, at least for some VCs, I said.
Let's go to the second question. What kind of competitive position will you have? What makes your products or services unique and compelling enough to ward off copycats? Can you stake out a significant chunk of your market and defend it? Or can someone reproduce what you're doing overnight?
Lenny explained that federal regulations aimed specifically at the funeral business created an opportunity for his venture. Funeral homes must accept caskets provided by third parties without fee. The trouble is that the regulations extend that opportunity to everybody, not just Lenny. Like other internet merchants, he would bank on the limited ability of brick-and-mortar merchants to cut prices. But with these margins, who knows? And what about internet-based competition? Where were the barriers to entry? His answers were not satisfactory. He was offering nothing that another competitor couldn't also develop. The key to his business was swift execution. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. But fundamentally, there was a risk that, after funerals.com gentrified the neighborhood, some brick-and-mortar heavyweights would sweep into town, or some internet speed freaks would catch funerals.com from behind. There were no safe havens unless Lenny could achieve Silicon Valley's new mantra, build brand. "How will people find you when they need you?" I asked. "How will funerals.com establish a brand and presence?" E-commerce is all about distribution, building awareness, being seen, and the web gatekeepers take a hefty toll before granting you access to their traffic. His plan was to work with the existing non-virtual infrastructure, social service departments, hospitals, clergy, and hospices, the people who know when someone dies. They would serve as referral points. But would they tell people about funerals.com? Would that word of mouth suffice in an age of internet portals? "Price, convenience, no pressure," he said. "They'll refer people because it's a better way to shop." "You said a while ago, when someone dies, no one wants to shop around," I pointed out. He made a note, probably a reminder, to take that sentence out of his pitch. "Some won't, some will," he said. "Besides, nothing prevents someone else from making the same offer," I challenged. "If that happens, where are you?" "So far ahead, nobody can catch us," he said. First mover status might confer some advantage, but how much wasn't clear. The need to move with ferocious speed is the internet's legacy. If nothing else, e-commerce forces every business to accelerate to defend its turf or cede precious market share to the fleet-footed mammals of the web. "If we beef up that point in the plan, will it make a difference to Frank?" "You need to address it. It's a threshold question." He made some more notes. My chai was getting cold. Maybe Connie would be so kind as to warm it up. I turned toward the window and waved to her inside. She ignored me, deliberately not looking my way. No respect. "That takes us to the third question," I said, turning back to Lenny. "You and your team. Your first mover status relies on rapid execution. That means the composition of your team is even more crucial than usual, because you won't have time to learn on the job." "It will be a good team." He reached into his case of files and handed me a copy of his business plan. "There's a summary of people in here," he said. So there was. Unfortunately, besides Lenny, there was only one other founder identified by name. She was a marketing manager for one of the biggest funeral home chains, so she would be the domain expert. He obviously didn't suspect I had overheard his earlier conversation regarding his teammate bailing. I told Lenny I was troubled by his and his partner's lack of startup experience. "It heightens the risk. Startups are unique animals. We take them pretty much for granted out here now, but they are still endeavors that require very different skills from the ones needed in established companies. Like tourists on safari, senior executives from some of America's largest corporations come to the valley to study the exotic ways of the natives. Arriving from Chicago or New York or Dallas, they think they need to be more like Silicon Valley startups, but they usually end up scratching their heads. I recently met with some senior managers from a world-class packaged goods company who'd been up and down the valley. We thought we could take a crash course in the valley way and apply the lessons to our business. But this place is extremely foreign to us. We'll have to partner with experienced startup talent and valley VCs if we really want to try our hand at being entrepreneurial," a senior manager confessed. "Even when large companies try to set up small, entrepreneurial units, they are hard-pressed to find people inside the company who will drive them with the same fervor and penny-pinching zeal that desperation demands of independent startups. the accoutrements of established businesses, the company cafeteria, the clerical support, the illusory job security, the pension plans, and everything else a large organization can provide are inconsistent with Valley startup mentality. I'm not concerned about it, Lonnie shot back. We have a good plan, and we know how to work a plan. I thumbed through the material. It was a fairly polished presentation. Market description, customer need, product strategy, competitive positioning, launch schedule, sales projections, expense forecasts, IRR, and other rates of return, investment required, discounted cash flow, all the numbers you'd want. Year one, year two, year three. Everything worked out with an inevitable logic. Lenny had outlined in some detail how he planned to run this business. But how would he react when reality swept over his PowerPoint slides? It was becoming clear that he believed his task was to raise money and then follow his plan. As far as he was concerned, the answers were all there. That's the drill in large companies. Work the plan. Every week or month or quarter, the head of a new venture will meet with senior management and report progress against plan. I once sat on the board of a startup that had raised an initial round of funding from a wealthy Hollywood financier. This was the kind of startup the Valley fondly refers to as Brave New World. The other kind is more soberly called Better, Faster, Cheaper. This particular startup envisioned a business based on a radically new product and service. Naturally, the business plan laid out detailed projections, but everything was based on assumptions that could not be tested short of actually starting the business. Of course, the business at that time was nowhere near the place specified in the plan. Crucial distribution partners were not moving as quickly as expected, and their involvement remained outside our control. The financier, who had made billions in oil and gas, was troubled and became progressively more upset when he learned the company was falling farther behind and away from plan. He was a savvy investor, but he was not acquainted with technology startups and was increasingly rattled by the risk inherent in this venture. Finally, after yet another hand-wringing board meeting in which one of the financier's henchmen screamed, threatened to cut off funding, and jumped management through innumerable hoops, I took the fellow aside. I explained that in a Brave New World startup, there's no existing market, no incumbent competitors, and no economic model. You are literally inventing the business as you go along. It was absurd, I told him, to hold the team to the original plan. Look at the progress they'd made on everything within their control, such as the quality of the organization and the status of the product. It was necessary to be vigilant and flexible in order to learn as the business progressed. These were the right indicia of success at this point, not the plan. The management team was obviously working hard to close a deal with distribution partners and was pursuing alternative strategies. By any measure, except the original plan, this team was doing a great job. The principal use of the plan comes at the beginning, I explained, to show that the founders are intelligent, capable of structuring the business concept and expressing a vision of the future. Later, the plan can help track problems that may reflect on the startup strategy itself. The financier's henchman calmed down, but his boss never really got the point. He dropped out before the company went on to be sold for more than $500 million. Lenny, I said, I doubt your plan will take you all the way. There are too many unknowns. You'll need people capable of navigating without street signs. The composition and the experience of the team are something VCs will look at hard. VCs invest first and foremost, I explained, in people. The team would have to be intelligent and tireless. They would need to be skilled in their functional areas, though not necessarily highly experienced. Moreover, they would need to be flexible and capable of learning quickly. Heaps of information about the market and the competition would be streaming in after they launched. They would have to course correct on the fly, refine the strategy, maybe even radically. This team would have to be comfortable with uncertainty and change. That's why VCs look for people with some startup experience, people who have proven they can thrive in chaos. It significantly reduces the risk of failure. If we can get a VC to put in the money, Lenny said, and then work with us to fill in the gaps in our experience, we should be all right. If Lenny was relying on the VC to provide the startup experience his team lacked, he was confused about venture capitalists and their role. He wasn't alone. Venture capital firms have a great business, the investment business. They bring in money from limited partners, and it's their job to give back to those limited partners return that reflects the risk taken with the money and exceeds what they are likely to get from other investments. For that effort, the VC gets a fee and a carry, a percent of the deals gratis. In the early days, VCs often rolled up their own sleeves to make their investments successful. Many had come from operating roles and could actively contribute to the businesses they funded. The total money they had to invest was trivial by today's standards, which meant that they could make only a handful of investments annually, a manageable number that allowed them to bring their experience with their money to each venture. Today's funds are huge in comparison, sometimes approaching $1 billion. Because of this size, VCs now need to invest larger amounts of money in more companies to produce the returns that attract investors. It's not uncommon for a VC partner to sit on a dozen or more boards. To that, they have to add the hefty demands of running their own businesses. Consequently, most VCs, even if they insist otherwise, simply don't have the time to give close management attention to the companies they've funded. In addition, in contrast to the original VCs, who often gathered years of operating experience prior to becoming venture capitalists, many partners in today's firms have no executive management experience. They could be working on Wall Street as easily as on Sand Hill Road. With frenetic energy and a natural penchant for risk-taking, these armies of prospectors are smart, hardworking, and aggressive. They do bring connections and contacts to the aid of the companies they fund, in addition to money. Often stereotyped as vulture capitalists who drive expensive cars, drink pricey wines, collect extravagant toys, and wish they had time to indulge in their expensive hobbies, they are reminiscent of Wall Street Masters of the Universe, or LA Players, except for one thing. Their bets build the future in remarkably tangible ways. While their New York and LA counterparts feast on marble steaks from the corner butcher, VCs birth, fatten, and butcher their own steers before the barbecue. Take them out of the picture, and the valley and its financial boom collapse. A few of the venture capital firms are beginning to recognize the limitations of the current stretched-thin situation, and there are, of course, some notable exceptions to the present trend. Regardless of the amount of attention they can spend on any single company, they are still some of the heroes of the new economy. Nevertheless, for the last few years, there has been no shortage of capital and new ideas in the Valley. Management talent has been the limiting factor. Startups require an odd mix of skills and personalities. Many top-tier VCs use their credibility to attract big-name talent from corporate America with a promise of huge payoffs in the Valley. This can ensure that a new venture sails smoothly out the gate. But when a small startup runs into trouble early, and many, if not most, do, carpetbaggers more accustomed to managing multi-billion-dollar businesses may find they just don't have the skills to make a startup work. Anyone can sail with the wind to his back. Startups usually sail into a stiff wind, leaking like a sieve, in high seas without food or water. If Lenny got the money he wanted for funerals.com, he would face that problem right away. How committed is the other founder? I asked. For the first time, Lenny deflected his gaze as he spoke. She'll join as soon as we can raise enough money. Was he lying to me or deceiving himself? Remind me how much you're looking for, I asked. $5 million to build the basic service and distribution network, develop relationships with manufacturers, and flesh it all out. We could roll out in 6 months. Not an unreasonable amount, and consistent with the VC's need to put a lot of money into each deal. $5 million at what valuation? $25 million? Good luck. I shook my head. Lenny was deluding himself. He was looking for a large valuation so he could raise his financing by selling the smallest percentage of the company possible, thus maximizing his ownership. The Valley calls that minimizing dilution. $50 million in sales the second year will make this a bargain, and I can quote comps. Lenny, you have an idea, a co-founder, a business plan. Nothing earth-shaking or inherently valuable like an exclusive market or key patent. No track record. You need to reset your expectations. I had to explain. Valuation is all about risk and reward. Sure, $50 million is a sizable business, but what are the chances for failure or delay? And how much money would he ultimately need to be successful? Future dilution would have to be figured in the mix. The lead VC is more likely to want around 40% of the deal for his money at this stage. If Lenny were to raise $5 million, 40% would mean that the post-money valuation, the value of the company plus the new money, would be more like $12.5 million. Subtract the investment, and you have a $7.5 million pre-money valuation, the implied value of the business. Nowhere near the $25 million Lenny was suggesting. Everybody here brags about valuation, but Silicon Valley really operates on momentum. Many times I caution a company not to take the largest valuation they can in a financing because it sets the wrong expectation and probably attracts the wrong investors. Peg the round at the highest reasonable price necessary to raise the desired amount from the right investors. The right investors bring credibility, experience, and networks. They support you with enthusiasm in later rounds. They raise your valuation merely by their presence in the deal. The right amount to raise is a range with a minimum, but seldom a relevant maximum. In a fiery market like ours, raise enough for a year's burn rate, or net loss, assuming the worst. Then add on enough for another 6 months, and take anything reasonably offered above that. I have never seen a company fail for having too much money. Dilution is nominal, but running out of money is terminal. Set reasonable expectations among your investors, don't gouge them, and then outperform expectations. Future rounds will be much easier if you are seen as having positive momentum. If you are fixated on dilution, you could take less cash and focus maniacally on meeting critical milestones in order to raise your valuation before soliciting more investment and experiencing further dilution. But beware that you risk underperforming or, even worse, falling prey to changes in market attitudes or conditions that may make future rounds more expensive or even impossible to raise. If you hit a snag, your precious momentum goes out the window. The current euphoric markets make it advisable to take all the money you can while the bloom is on the rose. Lenny took more notes. Two friends of mine noisily entered the Conditori, deep in argument. Tom insisted that eBay was a buy at $150 per share. Steve was incredulous, as always, muttering about the tulip craze in 17th century Amsterdam. Their debate revived itself daily without ever producing an apparent winner. Tom had made millions investing in internet startups in the past few years. Steve had probably scraped by on a balanced diet of blue chips and mutual funds, but he insisted he'd get the last laugh. They grabbed their takeout orders and waved as they left, aware that the door to my office was, for the time being, closed. Lenny, I said, you mentioned your exit strategy, selling out or doing an IPO in 3 years or so. More likely a sale. His explanation held little surprise, since the way to create a retailing business on the web has become fairly straightforward. raise money, build a site where you can offer attractive, fun, informative content, as well as a wide choice of steeply discounted products. Focus entirely on growing sales and your customer list at a phenomenal rate. Expand your product lines. Grow even faster. Go public. Profits and margins be damned. According to Lenny's logic, an established e-tailer suffering from negative margins might eventually be interested in acquiring niche lines of high-ticket, high-margin products like his funeral gear. Most likely, he said, he would sell funerals.com in 2 or 3 years to one of the larger web retailers. Personally, I could not fathom Amazon selling caskets, but that wasn't important now. There was a bigger issue here. That's an exit strategy for your investors. Is it one for you too? For me too. He seemed confused by the question. After all, wasn't he an investor? Is that your personal exit strategy? Are you planning to get out? Yes, of course. If you raise money and do this, I asked, but it doesn't work quite like you planned. You don't get the gold or silver or even brass ring. Will you think it was a waste of your time? It would be a disappointment, he said. He didn't say he would consider it a total failure, but that was the message in his voice and on his face when he spoke. I thought about that for a second. Lenny was clearly mystified by my questions. All right, I said. I think I have a better sense now of what you have in mind. I'll talk to Frank. What will you tell him? Are you on board? Am I on board? That was the question. The market is huge and rather unusual. Lenny's plan demonstrated that he knew his beans about the business of dying. Iffy, but who knows? Funerals.com might be a big success. I'll tell Frank it's probably worth going to the next step and doing some due diligence, I said. He'll raise many of the same questions I did about your people and your ability to build some sustainable advantage. You have to see where that leads. That's great. And he leapt up from the table, hopefully. So you basically like it. I think Frank should go the next step. Then you'll work with us? With a yes and a handshake, I could show Lenny a faint ray of light after weeks and months of gloom. I don't think so, Lenny. His jaw dropped a fraction, and disappointment washed over his face. Chapter 3. The Virtual CEO. Some people call me an angel. In the world of startups, angels invest in seed or early-stage deals, and with their money, they lend a bit of advice. They pay for the privilege of helping the company. But I'm no angel. This was a point of confusion for Lenny. He'd assumed I was just some kind of newfangled Silicon Valley investor. But your VC analysis suggests that funerals.com is worth a closer look, he protested when I declined his invitation. That's what you're telling Frank. Why wouldn't you do the same? I don't necessarily look at things the way a VC does, I said, seeing that my comments were tripping him up. I've worked in Silicon Valley since the early 80s. I understand how it functions and thinks, but I don't necessarily see things the same way. If you're not interested in helping us, Frank won't be, Lenny said unhappily. Did he say that? I asked. It sometimes happens. A VC, concerned about the lack of experience among a group of founders, might ask them to involve a little gray hair, or in my case, a shaved head, with some startup management credentials. Not in so many words, but I thought if you invested... Sometimes I do put money into companies, but generally not in the startups I work with. If I invest, I'm prone to think like an investor, favoring my returns over what's best for the team and often its long-term business. I explained to Lenny what I do. I incubate startups. To that end, I provide the scarcest commodity of all, leadership and experience. I help the people build their ideas into successful businesses. Neither an angel nor a consultant, I support entrepreneurs as a kind of junior partner, a full member of the team, an owner and decision maker, not a hired hand. I invest my time, and in return, I receive an equity stake in the business. With that stake, I think like a team member and sink or swim with the founders. Some people call me a virtual CEO. When Steve Perlman founded WebTV some time ago, I agreed to help him get started, first as an advisor and then as a member of his board. Gradually, I became more active in the business, but I declined to assume a traditional role as an executive in the company. One day in 1996, Steve presented me with business cards that read, Randy Commissar, Virtual CEO, WebTV. The title stuck. I started working with a handful of companies at a time. I generally devote myself to each for a year, perhaps two. In that period, we should be able to raise money, develop the product or service, identify the market, create a business model, prove out its basic tenets, and hire an operating team. With that team in place, I retreat to an advisory capacity and give more hands-on attention to the next startup. My specific work in each of the companies depends on the backgrounds of the founders and the particulars of the business. My work is improvisational. Though involved in all the planning and major decision-making, I don't play any day-to-day operating role. On the org chart, I'm a bubble around the management team. Startups require frenetic execution and relentless perseverance. My role is to keep my head out of the cyclone and provide insight, direction, and stability. I try to bring to each company the experience I've gained, raising money, setting strategy, building and leading teams, establishing strategic relationships, developing products and services, and bringing them to market, doing deals. And I make available to the startup all my contacts in the industry. Good entrepreneurs are passionate visionaries, usually with one or more exceptional talents, but rarely have they actually built a company from scratch. I fill in the gaps in their experience. The actual CEO is ultimately responsible for all the company decisions. As a virtual CEO, I simply provide the team with guidance and leadership when necessary. I can be very outspoken if I fear that we don't have room for a misstep. But the CEO is in charge, and I'm there to make him or her successful. When I advise a startup, the business for me is the founders. It's an expression of their collective vision. As a director of a publicly held company, I accept a fiduciary duty to the investors. But in a privately held startup, I don't favor the investors over the founders. This is probably the crucial way my thinking differs from a VC's. Lenny, let's be clear on a few points here, I said. I need to understand why you're starting funerals.com in the first place. To prove I can succeed in the startup game, he said, and to get rich, why else? Okay, I said, but what will you do if you make the money? You have to do something. You're too young to clip coupons. He shrugged. There are other things I want to do. Ah, the crux of the matter. There's nothing wrong, I said, with cashing out and making a lot of money, unless those other things you intend to get to are what you'd rather be doing all along. I pointed at his plan. My experience tells me, if you do this for the money, you will just end up howling at the moon. The money's never there until it's there. There must be something more, a purpose that will sustain you when things look bleakest. Something worthy of the immense time and energy you will spend on this, even if it fails. He began rearranging his files, giving himself busy work, time to think. What am I missing? Finally erupted out of him. Isn't that how it works out here? Lenny, that approach simply isn't interesting to me. I don't have time to invest in merely building bank accounts. I realize as much as the next guy that the average startup will be acquired. By any calculation, there's no call for the number of independent companies we are creating in the valley. Many are simply products or services masquerading as companies. I can accept that as a dictate of the market, but I can't muster the energy for a company whose founders never hope to accomplish anything more than making some bucks. By setting your expectations low, you almost guarantee mediocrity. The Konditorei had filled with a din of young children. One or two of the kids ran around berserk, their Nordic nannies chasing after them. I spotted an old friend, Sarah, from my time at Apple in the mid-1980s, and got up to give her a hug. She lives nearby with two small children now, married to one of the ex-vice presidents of engineering during the Scully regime. She loves to ride horses, but the kids seem to occupy all of her time. I only run into her here at the Konditorei. Whenever I see her quickly growing children, I marvel at how much time has passed. Better watch out. I had never planned to grow old in this valley. I introduced Sarah to Lenny and then sat back down as she walked to her car, threatening to really get together one of these days. "You know," Lenny said, "I have to tell you, I don't get this at all. I thought you'd just say you didn't like the products, too creepy, or you didn't like my tie. But this is Silicon Valley, where you go to get rich." "Yeah, yeah. The Entrepreneur's Casino. Everyone knows the score. Get the venture money and return it at rates that make a loan shark misty-eyed." "I'm not talking about Silicon Valley," I reminded Lenny. "You asked if I was interested, remember? This is how I look at a business." Lenny raised an eyebrow. He must have felt like he stumbled into some renegade lodge of Freemasons. He thought he'd learned the secret handshakes, the passwords, the arcane rituals, but what he'd learned obviously wasn't working on me. "Are you saying I shouldn't be doing this?" he asked accusingly. "You telling me to give up? Is that what you think?" "Not at all. I never tell anyone to quit," I said. "I may not want to be involved, or I may think your idea is likely to break your heart or your bank account, but I never say quit." "Then I'd like to know your opinion. If we get the money, even if you don't join us, what do you think of our chances?" "Lenny, your plan calls for raising as much money as possible and then launching your business as soon as possible. You predict an opening in the online market for these funerary goods, and you need to fill that hole quickly and completely." "Right," he said. "It's that internet land rush. If you're going to dominate the market, like you say, we'll have to sprint, even if we start today." Lenny's eagerness to charge ahead was laudable. It certainly matched the way the Valley now works. Over the last several years, with more money and more deals and less attention paid to any single company, a new investment model had taken hold. Fill each startup with rocket fuel as fast as possible and blast it into space. The ones that fly, fly. If the rest of them blow up, c'est la vie. "It's not quite that simple," I quipped. "What are you saying?" Lenny wanted to know. "We shouldn't move quickly?" "Lenny, you're selling known products to an existing market. Your competitors, at least your brick-and-mortar competitors, are identifiable. That all says you're probably a better, faster, cheaper startup. Your goal is to unseat the brick-and-mortar incumbents. Your biggest bet is that people will buy these things online." "A big bet indeed, but there's no brain surgery in it. So the rocket ship model is probably the right one for funerals.com. You should get on and go as far and as fast as possible." "Then what's the problem?" I explained there were two issues. The first faces all web rocket ships. We're awfully early in this market to be declaring the first movers the victors. Our perspective is too short, and it colors the lessons we think we're learning. 3DO was a first mover in the so-called next-generation video game business, yet it was completely overrun by later entrants Sony and Nintendo. And that's just one example I happen to know firsthand. It's not clear that being the first mover will provide the rash of internet startups a sustainable competitive advantage. Ultimately, being right or better positioned may be more important than being first. "Your second hurdle," I told Lenny, "is that in spite of all that's known about your products and market, you still face some big, unanswered questions. As happens with most startups, Lenny's plan raised questions that couldn't be answered until he actually launched Funerals.com. How many people will buy funeral goods on the web? For goods evoking so many layers of complex emotion, can you do without human contact? What's the market segment that will respond on the net, and what are the specific products and services those people want? What's the best way to attract customers? How will you work with local funeral homes to ensure a satisfactory experience for customers? None of those answers is obvious, Lenny, I said, but each answer is crucial to your success. Your rocket ship may fly in the wrong direction and blow up or run out of fuel. Lenny was skeptical. He had no trouble naming a half dozen rockets that flew just fine. In fact, the rocket ship model of startup investment has recently produced many of the most prominent Valley successes. But for every one of them, there are many potentially viable companies that might have eventually prospered if they had been incubated longer. When too much money is pumped too fast into a startup, there's no room for mistakes. The initial product and the initial fix on the market have to be right. There's no way these companies can stop and reconsider what they're doing without a great deal of pain. They lose momentum, and that sense of momentum, in terms of market acceptance, financing opportunities, partnership interest, and the ability to attract talent, is crucial in the Valley. The dreaded restart, writing down a company's value and raising new money around a fresh direction for the business, means all the previous work was for naught. Everyone loses, especially the founders. More often, the walking wounded are simply sold off for the value of their assets or scuttled entirely. Some startups, Brave New World startups especially, need to proceed more gingerly because there are no precedents to guide them. They need to feel their way for a while, operating by trial and error. In those cases, my approach is different, because my goal is to optimize the company, not maximize a portfolio. Take one of the startups I'm working with right now. It's offering a new kind of marketing and promotion service on the internet. But how and when the market is going to develop, who knows? A typical VC might have pounded money into this business and forced it to ramp up before it had enough experience with customers and the service to aim properly. My advice? Stay small and remain flexible for the time being, so we can keep close to the market, learn from prospective customers, and afford to take some missteps. You have to be able to survive mistakes in order to learn, and you have to learn in order to create sustainable success. Once the market is understood and the product is fully developed, then move fast and hard. If, on the other hand, we discover with this approach that there's no market after all, we won't have wasted truckloads of money. Don't get me wrong, Lenny, I said. I'm all for moving fast. There are times when the rocket ship is the right way to go. It may be the right way for funerals.com. I'm only saying it's not necessarily the case. That's an important question for you to confront. I looked at my watch and saw it was time to move on. I stood up. The Konditori was in its mid-morning lull. Only a few real estate agents were coming in to perk up with some caffeine before confronting their first desperate clients of the day. Selling million-dollar teardowns and multi-million-dollar fixer-uppers could take it out of you. Luckily, demand far outstripped supply in this market. After the first dozen curb calls, you could usually count on hungry home buyers to knuckle under, feeling thankful for the privilege to bid on condemnable estates. I recognized one of the agents and nodded hello. "Hey, Commissar," he said, "I've just a thing for you. A very private, charming, Asian-inspired place on the ridge, terrific view, not even listed yet. I could get you in for a peek." "Sam, I have enough to worry about without taking on a new house. I haven't paid for the one I'm in yet. Look around for another motivated buyer. You may even have to get out of your chair to sell this one." Lenny reached over for the business plan that was still on the table. His hand on the document, he tried one more time. "Why don't you take a copy?"